Thanks, Jacob. So yesterday, what did we hear about? Yeah, what happened?
Oh, we heard about the Shiva Dwara being defeated by Vishnu Dwara and then surrendering to Krishna, offering nice prayers.
Three or four prayers, very simple, and Krishna was pleased.
So Krishna gave him shelter.
He also gave him an order. Do you remember what that order was?
Not to bother any devotees. At the time of death, the devotees won't be afraid of you.
Yeah, well, yeah. They may get fever, but they won't get the fear that for non-devotees accompanies that fever. Then Banasura became more and more furious, and he attacked Krishna again. Sometimes I've read some saying to the effect of, the genius is not sufficient. You also need determination. But determination is not sufficient, because Banasura had determination, but it was to do the wrong thing. So, finally, after Krishna, using his chakra, cut off 996 of his arms, which must be quite an experience. Then Lord Shiva decided to save him by giving him his mercy. And he prayed to Krishna on behalf of Banasura. So now the 64th chapter begins, and this is, so this whole section, 61 was the killing of Rukmi and the whole genealogical table of Krishna. So it could all, when we spoke about that pastime, it looked so ordinary in its sense, that Balaram became angry at Rukmi because he cheated him, and Balaram just killed him. And then in the next chapter, Usha comes to, calls Aniruddha via Chitraleka, and the father is upset and chastises Aniruddha, and Aniruddha's father comes with the grandfather comes with a huge army and chastises Banasura. So it sounds like Krishna, he's like a transcendental bully or something like that. If he doesn't get what he wants, he just calls out his armies or his chakra or something like that. And in some senses, obviously the word bully is not the appropriate word, but one could say Krishna always gets what he wants. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur coined the phrase the transcendental autocrat. And indeed, Krishna is the transcendental autocrat. That means Ekala Ishwara Krishna are Sabha-Britya. But he is the only Lord. And when we hear of the activities of Krishna, there's a tendency for the false ego to think, well, that's not fair. I mean, why did he act in this way? Why did he act in this way? But the reality is that he is the transcendental autocrat. And everything he does is by his will. And he is the only one who is independent, and he defines what is good and what is not good. He is the absolute good. So it's very hard for the conditioned soul to accept this, because we would prefer to have our consciousness, our mind, define what is good and what is not good according to our own conception. But when we think about it, is that Krishna is the only one who knows everything. He's omniscient. He's all-knowing. And we know just a little bit. So from our little perspective, something may seem good, but looking at it from another perspective, it may seem the same thing may seem terrible. So it's not possible. What's an example of this? That the ant may be wanting to take this little piece of sugar, and he thinks it's so wonderful. And of course, the person who's he goes into the honey to get it, and he doesn't see the whole truth of the fact that he's going to drown and die in the honey, because his perspective is just this ant's little perspective. And then the bigger perspective is the person who sees that the ant is crawling into the honey and he's going to drown in honey. I guess that's the ant's perfection of how to go from this world, is drowning in honey. But so the person who has the biggest perspective, or who has the whole perspective, is the only one who can judge what is good and what is bad ultimately. So the first point is that we really can't judge, and we have to accept Krishna's position and the position of Shastra and the position of the exalted sadhus to give us our vision, and therefore we say that prayer, Om Agnanatami Andasya Agnaya Salaka Chaksus Unmilitam Jaina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So it's an offering of thanks and respect to the Guru for giving us the eyes of Shastra and teaching us what knowledge is, because otherwise our eyes are closed, and with our closed eyes we're thinking that we see accurately, just like the ant is thinking he is seeing accurately, but he's not seeing his own death. So Krishna defines what is good, and he's come specifically to kill the demoniac forces, and Banasura is one of them, and Rukmi was one of them. And these two were actually quite inimical, completely inimical to Krishna and to the devotees and to proper principles. So Krishna had come to remove the burden of the earth, and they were part of it. So that's the cosmic perspective. So there's the moral perspective, there's the cosmic perspective, and ultimately there's Krishna's perspective. So the next chapter is also it's also a funny in a sense chapter. The next chapter is about King Nriga. And King Nriga, as we shall hear, was the son of Ichaku. And this pastime, what I'll do is I'll read it quickly, and then we'll see if after, we'll go back and see that there's something very wonderful in it that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur reveals in it. Otherwise, it's a short chapter, and it sounds as if there's nothing deeply spiritual in it, but actually there is something of the deepest level. So I'll read it. I'll read Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's comment. That reveals everything. So more family business is how this pastime starts. Sri Badarayani said, "O King, one day Samba, Pradyumna, Charu, Banu, Gada, and other young boys of the Yadu dynasty went to the small to a small forest to play. The boy. Srila Sridhar Swami states that the story of King Nriga, narrated in this chapter, is meant to give sober instructions to all proud kings. Through this incident, Lord Krishna also gave serious lessons to the members of his own family who had become proud of their own opulence, of their opulence. So there's different levels to this story. After playing for a long time, the members of the Yadu dynasty, these boys, became thirsty. As they searched for water, they looked inside a dry well and saw a peculiar creature. The boys were astonished to behold this creature, a lizard, who looked like a hill. What does that mean when it says it looked like a hill?
Big.
Oh, so big.
And also probably really uncomfortable because he looked at and too big for the holes.
They felt sorry for it and tried to lift it out of the well. They caught onto the trapped lizard with leather thongs and then with wooden woven ropes. But still they could not lift it out. So they went to Lord Krishna and excitedly told him about the creature. Prabhupada Jiva Goswami explains that because in this chapter the Yadu boys, even Sri Padumya, are described as quite young, this must be an early pastime. The lotus-eyed Supreme Lord, maintainer of the universe, went to the well and he saw the lizard. Then with his left hand, he easily lifted it out. Krishna does things easily with his left hand, like he lifted Govardhan Hill, because the right hand is naturally the stronger hand. And even though the boys couldn't lift it out, Krishna easily lifted it out with his left hand. And also the lizard was dirty. Touched by the hand of the glorious Supreme Lord, the being at once gave up its lizard form and assumed that of a resident of heaven. His complexion was beautifully colored like molten gold, and he was adorned with wonderful ornaments, clothes, and garlands. Lord Krishna understood the situation, but to inform people in general, he inquired as follows. Who are you, O greatly fortunate one? Seeing your excellent form, I think you must surely be an exalted demigod. And then he asked the question, by what past activity were you brought to this condition? Now this is a very important question, because secretly it has two parts actually. One part is, how did you, such an exalted person, become trapped within a horrible, suffering body like a lizard? But hidden also is, how did you, who was an exalted person and a lizard, how did you come to get touched by the hand of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? I mean, it's not like every lizard gets touched, nor every demigod gets touched. So the answer to that question is going to be the ultimate secret of this chapter that Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur reveals. Sukadeva Goswami said, thus questioned by Krishna, whose forms are unlimited, the king, his helmet dazzling as the sun, bowed down to Lord Madhav and replied as follows. King Nriga said, I am known as Nriga, the son of Ikshaku. Perhaps, Lord, you have heard of me when lists of charitable men were recited. Purport. The Acharyas point out that here, although a tentative expression is used, perhaps you have heard of me, the implication is, there is no doubt that you have heard of me. In other words, he was very famous as being charitable. What could possibly be unknown to you, O Master? With vision unperturbed by time, you witness the minds of all living beings. Nevertheless, on your order, I will speak. So he's saying you actually know who I am and how I got into this position. But you've ordered me to speak. So I will. So now we'll tell this story. I gave in charity as many cows as there are grains of sand on the earth, stars in the heaven, or drops in a rain shower. Now, just think of how many cows that is. That's really innumerable, or practically speaking, an infinite number of cows. Innumerable cows in charity. Young, brown, milk-laden cows who are well-behaved, beautiful, and endowed with good qualities, who are all acquired honestly, and who had gilded horns, silver-plated hoofs, and decorations of fine ornamental cloth and garlands. Such were the cows, along with their calves, that I gave in charity. So, there are different kinds of charity that are given. One is like that story that the Prabhupada told, perhaps it was Gopal Bhan, who was walking, he was carrying some grains or something, and he was walking down the road, he was carrying these grains in some big bowl, and then he tripped as he was walking, and all the grains were falling out, so he quickly threw it up into the air and said, Govinda Bhog, you enjoy it. So that's one kind of charity. When you're going to lose what you have, since you're going to lose it anyway, you might as well give it to Krishna. You might as well offer it to God. And there's another kind of charity where you see this. I don't see so much charity in Australia, but India you see a lot of this one, where someone has land. And there's so much legal trouble with the land. You know, all his relatives are fighting him for the land. So he gives his part to the temple. Or people have... This one you see in the West is that someone has an old car that's falling apart. So they give it to the temple. That one you have seen? So that's another kind of charity. You give away things that you don't want, or they're useless. But there's still another kind of charity, which is the proper kind of charity that's mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Not quite as directly as this, is that one thinks that the wealth that he has isn't his wealth at all. But rather this is Krishna's money, and his job, his position, his duty is to manage it on Krishna's behalf and manage it wisely, manage Krishna's money wisely. So that's the proper, the highest type of charity. It's not thought of as charity at all, even in that sense. Charity and renunciation. What do we have to give? What do we have to give up? They're similar, like that. So, but if you look at his mood, is that he was giving high class charity, but not in the highest way. He was giving things that were very, very valuable. Young, brown, milk laden cows, not old cows that they were a burden to maintain. People do that too. And you give them away to the temple. Who are well behaved, not the cows that kick you when they're milking you so you don't want them. Beautiful and endowed with good qualities, who are all acquired honestly. And that's another thing, is that if one accepts charity of money and goods that were not acquired honestly, there is a bad reaction that one can get from that. So therefore, charity that one gets should be used very, very, very carefully. So the money, everything was acquired honestly. There's an old Vrindavan story of some old sadhu or something like that, and he had gone to some temple for prasadam or something like that, and after he came out, he was so upset and his mind was so disturbed and he was thinking all improper things and everything like that, and his consciousness stayed like that until he passed out everything, and then his consciousness was much better after that. And it said that because the money that was came that was used to purchase that food was black money. It was improperly earned money, so there was a reaction for that kind of charity, eating the food on that. So the subtle laws of nature at work. So, but his was everything was nice. So he mentions that the all acquired honestly, and they had gilded horns. Gilded means golden horns, silver plated hoofs, and decorations of fine ornamental cloths and garlands. Such were the cows, along with their calves. So they were satisfied when a cow has just given birth to a calf. It's when it's giving the most milk out of the affection for the calf, and it's fresh too. So he was saying that, look what kind of charity I was giving. This charity is so auspicious, and it brought me great results. So one would naturally be thinking, well, that doesn't quite answer the question of how you ended up as a lizard then, if you were supposed to get so much good results. So I first honored the Brahmins who were recipients of my charity by decorating them with fine ornaments. So he was humble. Those most exalted Brahmanas whose families were in need were young and possessed of excellent character and qualities. So the offering and he to whom the offering was being made were also qualified. The offering was of quality, and the persons were qualified. The families were in need, were young, and possessed of excellent character and qualities. They were dedicated to truth, famous for their austerity, vastly learned in the Vedic scriptures, and saintly in their behavior. I gave them cows, land, gold, and houses, along with horses, elephants, and marriageable girls with maidservants, as well as sesame, silver, fine beds, clothing, jewels, furniture, and chariots. In addition, I performed Vedic sacrifices and executed various pious welfare activities. So he was the perfection of a king in his charitableness. But once, and here is the complication, but once, only once, a cow belonging to a certain first-class brahmana wandered away and entered my herd. Unaware of this, I gave that cow in charity to a different brahmana. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami explains that the term Dvija Mukhya, first-class brahmana, here indicates a brahman who has stopped accepting charity and would thus refuse to accept even 100,000 cows in exchange for the cow that had been improperly given away. When the cow's first owner saw her being led away, he said, "She is mine." The second brahmana, who had accepted her as a gift, replied, "No, she is mine. Riga gave it to me." As the two brahmanas argued, each trying to fulfill his own purpose, they came to me. One of them said, "You gave me this cow." And the other said, "But you stole her from me." Hearing this, I was bewildered. Finding myself in a terrible dilemma concerning my duty in this situation, I humbly entreated both the Brahmins, "I will give 100,000 of the best cows in exchange for this one." Now, 100,000 cows, I mean, that's more than can fit in the football stadium. I mean, that's a lot, 100,000 cows. It's a lot of cows. How many is the most you've ever seen, petite cows in one place?
400.
Where did you see 400 cows? You're good, please give her back to me. I'll give you 100,000 cows. Give her back to me, please. Your good self should be merciful to me, your servant. I did not know what I was doing. He was so innocent in this. And he tried to get out of it to satisfy them. Please save me from this difficult situation, or I shall surely fall into a filthy hell. The present owner of the cow said, I don't want anything in exchange for this cow, O king, and went away. The other Brahmana declared, I don't even want 10,000 more cows than you are offering. And he too went away. Purport. In Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Srila Prabhupada comments, thus disagreeing with the king's proposal, both Brahmanas left the palace in anger, thinking that their lawful position had been usurped, taken away. O Lord of Lords, O Master of the Universe, the agents of Yamaraj, taking advantage of the opportunity thus created, later carried me to his abode. Thereafter, Yamaraj himself questioned me. According to the Acharyas, the king's performance of fruitive activities had previously been flawless, but now an inadvertent discrepancy had arisen. So when the king died, the Yamadutas took him to the abode of Yamaraj called Samyamani. Yamaraj said, my dear king, do you wish to experience the results of your sins first, or those of your piety? Indeed, I see no end to the dutiful charity you have performed, or to your consequent enjoyment in the radiant heavenly planets. So which do you want first? There is no end to what you're going to enjoy. And interestingly enough, because he's going to choose, he replied, first, my Lord, let me suffer my sinful reactions. Now, Prabhupada even says over here, Yamaraj also hinted that he did not know the limit of the king's future enjoyment. In other words, there'd be practically no end to the king's material happiness. But in spite of this hint, the king, bewildered, decided first to suffer the results of his impious activities and then to accept the results of his pious activities. Therefore, Yamaraj immediately turned him into a lizard. So here's one question. I mean, there are some kinds of people, like, they save the best part, where they're taking prasadam, the thing that they like the most, they save right for the end. And this is the way some people are. But yet he's saying that, I mean, because say if you had almost unlimited enjoyment, but you knew that after that it's over, you're going to have to suffer. So it would seem, in one sense, like a natural thing to do, to take the misery first instead of, you know, just get it out of the way, the one thing that you did wrong, just get it out of the way so you could have your unlimited pious enjoyment. But yet, it's bewildered. He's considered to be bewildered. What do you think about that one? Why is he bewildered?
Is the nature of the piety was especially unlimited. Yeah.
Because if he was taking all that enjoyment, maybe he could sort of sort out that there was something on the way or something.
Right?
Got all this good fortune waiting for him.
Interesting, isn't it, though? And this also points to the essential flaw, I mean, not the point about bewildered, but the essential flaw in the karma mamangsa philosophy, my Jaimini Rishi, that's described in by Baladeva Vidyabhusana, I believe, one of his comments in the prayers of the personified Vedas, is that the basic karma mamangsa philosophy is that they don't believe in any eternal Vaikuntha or anything like that. They say that following the Vedas, according to what the Vedas say, the material world is what it is. This is what it is. It has everything in it. And there's no beyond the material world. This is all that's in existence. So their idea, basic idea, is to follow the Vedic performances of karma, of pious punya karma, of piety, and thereby, by performing sacrifices, which is the basic injunction of Jaimini Rishi, that perform sacrifices and enjoy eternal life. And you quote the Vedic statements that even said you perform the sacrifice and you'll enjoy eternally. And it's, of course, we see that in the context of innumerable years, or so many years, it's almost like eternity. Like when we hear that Brahma lives for how many countless thousands and millions and billions of years, it seems like forever. And you think, well, what's the difference between that and eternity? But then we hear, in the perspective of eternity, from our little perspective, that's what it seems like. But from the perspective of eternity, Brahma's lifetime is like a flash of lightning over the ocean. So the karma mamangsakas, their philosophy is basically to perform sacrifices, perform pious activities, accumulate as much possible piety of enjoyment as you possibly can, and then go and really enjoy, and then come back and do the same thing. And this way, practically, you can live forever by performing piety, pious activity. So the basic flaw in that Baladeva Vidyabhusana points out, and also is here, is that this is the material world, and you just can't do it all perfectly in the material world. You're bound to make a mistake, and some flaw is going to ruin your perfect performance. Some sand will get into your vision, into your eternal sweet rice, and it will cause you trouble. So it's not possible, actually, to do that, to flawlessly live forever on the material platform in a perfect way. So this is what's happened to Nriga. And this is the tendency of pious materialists to think in this way, is that I'll accumulate my piety, and that's even part of the demonic nature, as the Bhagavad Gita describes. I'm just going to accumulate unlimited piety, and I shall enjoy. But this is the material world, and as long as we're thinking I shall enjoy with me as the center, we will not be able to enjoy. Some misery will find us and attack us, like it did with Nriga, because it's just not the way that this place works.
Is this very kind of prevalent as an underlying philosophy, you'd say, especially in India?
Which? Karma mamangsa?
Yeah.
Well, this is basic smarta Brahmanism,
yeah.
Basically.
It sounds kind of like something you've met somewhere.
That I've met personally?
I've met, you know, my time in India.
I don't know who you've been talking to.
But this concept of the piety and the lifestyle that looks very elevated, but that underneath it, the intention behind all the piety and the sacrifices and the
worship
is firmly
materialistic
here in this world.
Yes, well, that's basically what goes on.
There's no concept beyond that.
Yeah, no one basically wants to go to Golok. Even the Christian concept and the Islamic concept of heaven, you know, it has very little to do with God. You know, he's, I don't know what he does there. What is, you know, when you're growing up, what do you think? What, when you're enjoying in heaven, what is Jesus doing? He's just sitting, you know, what happens?
He's managing it.
He's managing your enjoyment.
He's arranging it for you.
Yeah.
Yeah? That's what people...
That's the concept, yeah.
Because I take my family with me, right? I mean, like, say, a Mormon.
Only if you're a Mormon.
I take my family with me. I take my dog and cat and my everything with me.
But it, so there's always the problem.
That, unless Jesus is right in the heart, in my heart of hearts of devotion now, I'm just going to elevate myself to a higher level of enjoyment the same as I know now. That's a Christian concept.
Yeah.
And the heaven is just a very much that.
Except that there's no phone bills and credit card payments.
All the bad things are gone. All the good things are maximized and the bad things are gone.
And obviously, really, no one has a very clear concept. Yeah. Obviously. And then, because your kids are there, right? Yeah. What?
Hopefully.
Hopefully or not hopefully, depending upon who they are. If they steal cars, I guess he gets. That's what heaven is like for those people. You steal cars and you don't get caught. Your heaven will be somebody else's hell.
In the Catholic tradition, as far as I understand it, if you take the whatever it's called
sacraments
right before death, you're not going to hell. So if you're not going to hell, and there's only heaven and hell.
There's purgatory for the Catholics, so they're the in between. To get rid of your impiety, to go.
I'm gonna wait until you're ready to move.
Yeah, and you work off your. But there's no concept of what heaven. It's basically enjoyment.
Yeah.
And the Islamic, it's quite wild what they, what's there in heaven. You know, it's really just.
Swagger.
Huh?
Like swagger.
It's like swagger, but not
beautiful
as.
Gardens and beautiful ladies.
Or beautiful young boys or whatever, you know, it's whatever you're into, you know. Yeah, and food and, yeah, it's really, it's a good place.
And they don't have a process of purification of removing those desires, they're actually retaining those.
Well, they don't want to remove them. So in other words, that's, service to God is not service to God, it's service to me, ultimately. And which is not where the Vaishnava religion begins. The Vaishnava religion begins with service to God, his love of God. It's based on love, and it's actually just service.
There's something quite extraordinary.
Something quite extraordinary. Yeah, it's wonderful. And once you understand it, then it's obvious. Although you might not like to hear it, it's obvious.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's why Prabhupada had so much, one of the reasons he had so much faith in book distribution and his books is because how can anyone not accept this? It's so obvious. So superior and obvious. It's such a clean conception.
Yeah.
If they just hear it.
To act on that level, you know, you may still fall back to your actions are all motivated in the same human-like way, but the presentation is of a different.
The ideal is the point being that I was trying to make is that this ideal is just so obviously. Superior.
Yeah.
And it also makes sense that if you're approaching God to go to heaven and you go to heaven, that's what you want.
Mm.
But he's not going to reveal to you exactly what the most intimate gifts that he has to offer you. And therefore it makes sense that these other religions don't know really much about the personality of Godhead because one, they don't want to know about the personality of Godhead. Their interest is in themselves. And secondly, they are not, because their interest is selfish, they're not trustworthy enough to know. So they have to have a more vague. And that's
a little distant.
Well, naturally.
To allow them there.
Like the king, no, you know, the king the common citizens don't, even if they're good citizens, don't know the personality of the king. They just know the official personality of the king. They shouldn't know more than that. And nor do they want to. And there's even in Salokya liberation, you're just living in the, you're living in the kingdom. That's all, basically. You have your own life, and then you go visit the Supreme Lord.
You mean that Salokya means that you're the same loka as the Lord, but it's not so that you can be nearby him so that you can have intimate service.
No, they don't want that.
It's like you have your place in his kingdom.
Yeah, that's what Salokya is. That's like, it's
okay.
Like the people of Puri, of Orissa. Mm-hmm. It's like that. They have their lives, but they still feel themselves, you know, Jagannath is everything for them, and he's the center, and they go visit him regularly,
mm-hmm.
like that, and they feel they're all devotees. But it's like Salokya liberation.
Mm-hmm.
They're living on the same planet.
And the other liberations, Swarupya?
It's, we have the same form. We should be. Yeah,
you
same
look
form.
Like him.
Yeah, like it's more intimacy. So, in any case, we were talking about King Riga, and he was bewildered. He didn't take, in one sense, what was obvious, more or less the hint that Yamaraj gave, that, you know, you're going to enjoy unlimitedly, let's go. Problem. So, but yet, he replied, first, my Lord, let me suffer my sinful reactions. And Yamaraj said, then fall. And once I fell, and while falling, I saw myself becoming a lizard, O Master. Now, this is what he says to Krishna. O Keshava, as your servant, I was devoted to the Brahmins and generous to them, and I always hankered for your audience. Therefore, even till now, I have never forgotten my past life. So he had a benediction that he could remember his past life. Okay, now here is the point that I was going to make, which really is the deciding and turning factor. So it's said that he's made a bad choice. Well, Prabhupada says that he's made a bad choice, but that bad choice has turned out to be the most fortunate choice because he's seen Krishna. So what is it that every bad choice we make causes us to see Krishna? Certainly not. But what was within him that caused him to actually see Krishna? And this, in one sense, is there are many instructions given in this, and this is the, in one sense, the essence of the instructions. Purport. Srila Jiva Goswami comments on this verse as follows, because I'll read the verse again, because this is an important verse here. O Keshava, as your servant, I was devoted to the Brahmins and generous to them, and I always hankered for your audience. So he always hankered for the audience of Krishna. So where does that come in? And why did someone who was so pious and always hankered for the audience of Krishna, why did he have to go to see Yamaraj? Which is another interesting question that the acharyas asked. Because, I mean, does that mean that if we make our little mistakes, what to speak of big mistakes, and we're trying to be devotees of Krishna, and we're hankering to be devotees of Krishna, are we going to have to see Yamaraj too? Well, according to what we've heard, we don't. The devotees, or even the aspiring devotees, don't have to see Yamaraj. So why did King Riga have to see Yamaraj? So, here's the verse again, and I'll read the comments. There's a comment of Srila Jiva Goswami, then something from Prabhupada, and then Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's comment. O Keshava, as your servant, I was devoted to the Brahmins and generous to them, and I always hankered for your audience. Therefore, even till now, I have never forgotten my past life. Srila Jiva Goswami comments on this verse as follows. Since King Riga openly declared that he had two outstanding qualities, namely devotion to the Brahmins and generosity. It is clear that he possessed these qualities only partially, since someone who is truly pure would not boast about them. It is also clear that King Riga considered such piety to be a separate goal, desirable for his own sake. Thus he did not fully appreciate pure devotional service to Lord Krishna. So here is one of the very important points, that he accepted the charity that he was doing as just piety. He wasn't thinking specifically that he was going to do it for the pleasure of Krishna, because the what he really desired was to please Krishna. So his consciousness was not actually devotional. He actually just by Daiva, by the Supreme Lord's mercy, did some agyata sakriti basically. He was giving charity, and one could say somewhat indiscriminately, and in his somewhat indiscriminate charity giving, pious, but not discriminately a service to Krishna. So some of his piety came to a devotee, his charity. So it is clear that King Riga considered such piety to be a separate goal, desirable for its own sake. Thus he did not fully appreciate pure devotional service to Lord Krishna. Because of this, he had to see Yamaraj, because he was in... When one's highest principle is charity, that means that one is in punya, that means that one is in the realm of karma, in the three modes of nature. So therefore he had to see Yamaraj. Thus he did not fully appreciate devotional service to Lord Krishna. Krishna had not been the only goal of Riga's life, as he was for Ambarish Maharaj, even in the stage of regulative practice. Nor do we find that King Riga overcame obstacles like those Ambarish did when Durvasa Muni became angry at him. Yeah. Because when we see that when he was basically cursed and he got his bad karma, Ambarish Maharaj got a completely different reaction, and so did the person who cursed him. Durvasa Muni was harassed by the chakra, who was devoted to protect Ambarish Maharaj and protect his city. So he couldn't overcome his obstacles because he actually wasn't a devotee. He was pious. Still, we conclude that since Riga was able to see the Lord for some reason or another, he must have had the good quality of sincerely desiring the Lord's association. So where did he get the good quality of sincerely desiring the Lord's association? There's only one place that one gets that good quality. Devotion only comes from devotees. So he must have had some association with devotees, and they must have blessed him. That's the conclusion, and Vishwanath will explain that in a little more detail. Srila Prabhupada confirms the above analysis in Krishna of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. On the whole, Riga had not developed Krishna consciousness. The Krishna conscious person develops love of God, Krishna, not love for pious or impious activities. Therefore, he is not subjected to the results of such action. As stated in the Brahma Samhita, a devotee, by the grace of the Lord, does not become subjected to the resultant reactions of fruitive activities. What's the verse in the Brahma Samhita? From Brahma to Indra Gopam.
As to Indra Gopam, Atavendra Mahosa Kama, Vandana Mahasa.
Yeah, anyway, that's the one. That for everyone from Brahma to the Indra Gopa is suffering or enjoying, basically suffering, the reactions to his previous activities. The situation we are in is action-reaction. It is a reaction. It is the resultant action of our piety and impiety. But a devotee is something different, someone different.
Kamali needs it.
Huh?
As long as Kamali needs it, he can talk to Bhakti Bhajan.
Govind, and therefore Govind, the Mani Krishna. Now here's Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's comment. So the Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur offers the following commentary. When Riga mentioned one who hankered to have your audience, he was referring to an incident concerning a certain great devotee King Riga had once met. The devotee was very eager to acquire a temple for a most beautiful deity of the Supreme Lord, and he also wanted copies of such scriptures as the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Being very generous, Riga arranged for these things, and the devotee was so satisfied that he blessed the king. My dear king, may you have the audience of the Supreme Lord. From that time on, Riga desired to see the Lord, and that is what was protected. Because sometimes the question is asked, well, when Krishna guarantees the devotee protection, but what is it that he's actually protecting? We see that he didn't protect Parikit Maharaj from dying. We see that he did protect Prahlad Maharaj. We see that he didn't protect Vidyadhara Chitraketu. He had to become a demon, Vitrasura. But he has his plan, even in his apparent non-protections. But he protects the consciousness of the devotee, and he protects him also in other ways, but according to the way he wants. That's what it appears. Anyway, but what because of his association and service to that devotee, he got a blessing. You will have audience of the Supreme Lord, and that also caused him to want to have the audience of the Supreme Lord. So this can only come from a devotee.
Can the question be raised that, like, say for ourselves, we're aspiring to become devotees, and we're partly devotees, and the rest of us is the rest of our consciousness is either impious or pious or mixed. So if the rest of consciousness was incredibly pious, and we had this budding part that was becoming eager to see Krishna, if he was predominantly something else, wouldn't it also leave us a bit open to see Yamaraj? We've got, you know, other things going on.
No, but piety and impiety both cause you to see Yamaraj.
The Yamadutas come here for the pious man as they do for having them?
Maybe they smile. But they, if someone has to take them out, where do they go? Maybe, I don't know. Yamaraj is, he's Dharma, not Dharmaraj. He's not just bad Karma Raj. But I don't know who comes for people who are only pious. Or
but here we are mixed, right? Mixed and also having this growing, gradually growing, maybe slowly growing, bhakti.
No, but the promise is, is it has to do, you know, that you won't see Yamaraj, even if one has taken initiation and is wearing tulsi around his neck, you won't see Yamaraj. If one has uttered the holy names of Krishna, I can't remember the shastra quotations for these things, but they're there, that he won't see Yamaraj, he won't be brought to the court of Yamaraj. Because in the sixth canto, that's what Yamaraj tells the Yamadutas, don't go near those who chant the holy names. Don't go near. And also Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, in his comment on that Yatatas Vishamativas, he explains that if you chant the names once without offense, it actually destroys all the sins in the future that you may ever commit. This is
I got you.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's a complicated topic that's not one to get into right now, but it's the potency of the holy names is something very special.
Is the any implication that all those brahmanas, like innumerable brahmanas, weren't Vaishnavas?
They obviously weren't.
Or is it that he wasn't?
That, I mean, there's no implication. Like, I mean, it's not talking about that. That's not the point at all. Because they might have been devotees, and you know, like just inspired by Krishna's lila shakti. Who knows? But it does. I mean, that's not how a devotee would act. Obviously, you know, anyway. But there's no. It's not. That's not part of the story. Whether they were Vaishnavas or not. Anyway, it's getting a bit late, so we'll do coffee, and then we'll continue tomorrow, and we'll continue the discussion. And can think about it. It's quite interesting, though. It's such a simple story, and you know, but there's a lot in it, a lot of deep points in it that are especially relevant for devotees, aspiring devotees. Questions or comments, but we'll continue tomorrow. We can start with questions, even.
Just an observation. Apart from this Vedic religion, all other concepts of religions are very, very imperfect. So, Deepa clearly says that Shirana Kurna, Mata Lota, Vishanti. And even if he's unlimitedly, he's enjoying the, you know, Swargalok, heavens. If that's a Christian and Muslim, both reach up to heavens. But the devotees don't even want to touch the heavens. They are much higher in their consciousness. So, and so they don't have this knowledge. It's Shreya Kunya and Martyrlok and Shanti, you see. So they look for, you know, heavens. Heavens means where you enjoy unlimited. You don't have this knowledge, very imperfect knowledge.
And if they don't have knowledge, the soul is different from the body. What to speak of now? Personality of Godhead, what to speak of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, what to speak of pleasure, what to speak of cows. And one could also say mostly the what they call the Abrahamic religions, the three religions also born out of that, the Middle East. So, you know, their activities are quite simple. The common activities, the meat eating, etc. So one can't get the highest thing if one has sinful consciousness. As Prabhupada used to point out, what kind of people you have to make one of the commandments, thou shalt not kill. Therefore, people who are killers. What to do? Therefore, it's a dangerous place, this world.
Very dangerous. And mysterious.
And mysterious.
What else is it?
Temporary. How come you're reading without your glasses and then you're not reading with your glasses on?
Oh, because what's it called when you're nearsighted? I can see better without the glasses on, with the close things. See? It is mysterious, isn't it? When you read, do you wear glasses or not?
Mm.
You don't wear glasses at all?
No.
Yeah. You don't use a computer, do you?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, a lot?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. That's wonderful.
When you become about 40, then you start needing these glasses.
He's almost 40. So much for your theory. His mother doesn't have glasses.
But she for phone numbers and the phone book, she uses a magnifying glass. But she can read the newspaper with glasses.
Constitution might differ here and there, but in general,
40-45. Well, no, she's reading without your glasses, then you put your glasses on and she finished reading.
Yeah,
different.
Okay, Hare Krishna. What to do?